Just a little bit about Stand With Us. Stand With Us is a Israel education organization. That means we come, we're focused on education, we come, we present facts, and we let people form their own opinions. We do this around the country and around the world. We're in 6 countries now and in every state. Our goal is to promote peace through education, in a sentence. What we have tonight is the Between the Lines tour. We have a fellowship in Israel. Just like we have a presence on college campuses in America, we have a presence at college campuses on Israel. And we have a fellowship that meets once a month, and they learn about Israel, which sounds interesting, but there's a need for it. And we take a few of the graduates of this program around the United States. So Udi and Shi are part of that program, and they're doing it in the Pacific Northwest, and there's groups that are going around in every region. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves because it's part of their shtick, and that's it.
Thanks, Arye. Hi, everyone. My name is Udi. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm always excited to be in El Shaddai. Right off the bat, I want to thank Pastor Mark for inviting us. I think today, Yud Aleph B'Cheshvan, that's the day that Rachel Imenu, the foremother, passed away. So it's extra special. She always taught us that we have no rights to complain in our lives because she had just the worst life ever. She had to give up her husband. She had to wait so much time. Her father, with all the idols and everything, her sons. She wasn't even buried properly in Hebron. So just thought it was worth mentioning the day. So again, I'm Udi. I'm 27 years old. I'm from Netivot, a small. This is not Netivot. This is Ashdod. Just a little bit about Israel's size before I go talk about my personal background. So size is not impressive at all. So Israel is about 1/9 of the size of Washington State. I grew up in a religious Orthodox home, Jewish home. Right away I mentioned the proximity to Gaza Strip, and it's going to come up later. But I'm just going to recap. Gaza Strip, that's the strip of land that used to be under the control of Israel. Israel in 2005 disengaged from that area, took all of its military and civilian presence with the hopes for peace. Peace did not come, and a year later, Hamas, the terror organization, takes over, shoots rockets. This is going to come up later. So back to my story. As you can see from my accent, and you'll see that again with Shir, English is not our native language. That's not our mother tongue. You know Hebrew, right? It's a beautiful language. It's ancient. The reason that I can speak English is because of these guys. Because I had friends growing up. So I'm a Moroccan Jew. Most Jews in Israel they come from European countries. They're of European descent, and they look different than me. I'm a Moroccan Jew. What does that mean? I'm Jewish. I do everything that's Jewish. I do Rosh Hashanah and Pesach and Sukkot, all these holidays. But we also have a holiday just for the Moroccan Jews, a holiday that its background came from us growing in Morocco. My parents came from Morocco. That's the picture. Down there is a henna ceremony that we have before we get married. A beautiful ceremony. We have different food, much better food than the regular Jewish gefilte and stuff. Also, I have to tell you, when I asked my parents why they didn't pass the one most important component of a culture, which is the language, why they didn't speak Moroccan Arabic to us, and then we would have known another language. They only used it when they didn't want us to understand, the kids. So I scolded my mother, and she said, she was like all of a sudden so serious, that serious, and tells me, we didn't want to burden you with the shackles of exile. We didn't want you to be dirty with these signs of oppression. Now you're independent. You have your own country. You are the first generation to speak Hebrew as a mother tongue. And that's just amazing. I'm interested in languages, so I'm trying to pick up Moroccan, and I have to tell you I found a new expression. So I just learned how to say I hear you in Moroccan Arabic. I hear what you are saying, and I respectfully disagree. In Moroccan, it goes like this. So you see, my interest is a very efficient language. So it's good that we are laughing. Now I'm going to talk about something less fortunate. We go back to Netivot. So Netivot, so close to the Gaza Strip. I wish that the Gaza Strip became the Paris of the Middle East, but it didn't. We have terrorists there, and they shoot rockets, and they build tunnels. Even today, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, found a tunnel that was built in order to kill and abduct innocent Israelis, and we destroyed it. So they shoot rockets. I was relatively old. I was 15 when it really became a thing. But my little brother, to the extreme right, he's 13 years younger than me. He was 2 when we gave the Gaza Strip. And he knows nothing. He doesn't know that a normal person does not grow with rockets falling on their houses. He doesn't know the fact that kids shouldn't listen to the television in a lower volume because, God forbid, there's a siren that might go off. Harder than it is to go through these experiences of running for your life to shelter, it's harder to understand, it's harder to explain to a kid that someone wants to kill you just for the mere fact that you're an Israeli and a Jew that lives in Israel. A couple of years back, so first of all, before I'll tell a little story, I just have to mention that for the past 3 years, the situation, reality in Israel has been relatively safe, relatively speaking. So maybe a rocket here and a rocket there, nothing that a normal country will accept, but Israel does. A couple of years back, 3 years, there was an operation. There was like one of these little skirmishes between the Israelis and the Hamas in Gaza. I was at my parents' house playing a video game. All of a sudden, the siren goes off. Nothing new. Always gets you the adrenaline going. So you, in my town, you have about 20-25 seconds to run and get cover. So I run to shelter. You look around the house to see that nobody's sleeping, nobody's in the bathroom or with headphones or something. So you see all these people, the people that you care about the most, and you all run to shelter. You close the door and you wait. You have just enough seconds to say your prayers. So we wait for the explosion, and usually the explosion will be remote, and will be maybe the rocket has maybe was even intercepted, because we have Iron Dome, and that's a good opportunity to thank America, which is Israel's greatest friend, for supporting that project of the Iron Dome. But that time it was different. We were waiting for the explosion, but instead of listening to it, we feel it. The walls tumble, the earth quaked. Then you feel it, and then you are immersed by the loudest sound that I've ever heard. You're in the shelter, and reality just goes upside down. We were sure that's our reality. That's the box. That's a black box, and you have no information of what's going on outside. I was sure that the house took a direct hit. So my sister and my sister-in-law, who was pregnant at the time, freaking out. They're crying. They're crying like crazy. They're trying to call the ambulances and the police. But guess what? All the neighborhoods trying to call use their cell phones at once, so the networks actually shut down. Eventually, I opened the door, and I see a house. The house was still standing. It didn't take a direct hit, but it wasn't the house that I grew up in. Like, that place that was supposed to be my refuge, the safest place for me, was completely different. It was a war zone. There's smoke that you smell gunpowder. It's like we've been uprooted and put in a war zone. It's just surreal. The windows shattered. The doors and drapes are bent. I walk in the house and I look at my little brother's bed, all made with the teddy bear, and it has so much debris from the ceiling. I open the front door and there I see the missile in the little road that leads to the house. And let me tell you, do you think that for the terrorists it's just enough, the missile, so it'll fall and kill somebody? That's not enough. They fill it with metal bullets and nails so it can kill as many innocent people as possible. So there I am, looking, still shocked, shocked to my bones, and I see the swing that my father sits in, and I see the chairs that my mother sits in, and they're pierced with these little bullets. And to this day, my father refuses to fix it. He says that's he wants to prove us how fragile life is. My mother says he's cheap. These security issues are severe. We're trying to keep a positive attitude, but it's so traumatic. And this is why Israel has to have the IDF. And this is why Israel, one of the reasons that in Israel there's a mandatory service. When I was 18, I was called for the military. And an agreement, I'm sorry, I'm fidgeting. An agreement with the military that first I'll go and study chemical engineering, so I'm actually a chemical engineer. Then when I was 22, I started at 18, studied for 4 years. By the way, in the University of Be'er Sheva, where 20% of the population of the students or so are Arabs. And you know what? They even have affirmative actions. If someone is an Arab, they have better chance with me if we have the exact same score. He has a better chance than me to get into. Because I don't know what people have told you, but Israel is a country with full civil rights and civil sensitivities. So I went to university, then I went to officer's training school. I'm an officer in the Israeli military and proud of it. For 6 months, I was trained physically, but I was mainly taught how to take moral decisions. Because I'm a commander and an officer in the Israeli military, and that's where the focus is. And we were taught, can we stay a Jewish and democratic state? That we spend so much time dwelling in these questions, because this is the Jewish way to make sure that we're as moral as possible in a complex reality. When I finished officer's training school, I kept serving for about 3 years in the Israel military as a chemical engineer in a secret facility, confidential. Then I finished. I discovered that it wasn't my passion in life. I wanted to do something different. I worked as a political advisor in the Israeli parliament, which is like our Congress. Did it for a couple of months. I heard about STEM With Us, the organization that I'm proud to be part of. They had a position in Seattle of a shaliach, of like an Israel educator. So I'm actually based in Seattle, and I go around the state of Washington, from Spokane to Bellingham, and even down to Portland, and I teach in public schools about Israel, not the fake news version of Israel, but the real Israel, and the kids get to ask questions. And this is an extension of that. So this is basically me. It's so important for me to be here and to talk to you, not because this is my favorite place, honestly, in the state of Washington, but because it's so important. I was talking to someone to get the information from the real people. That's the only way that you know that you're getting the truth. So I'm so excited to be here. I'm going to pass the mic to Shir, and she's going to share her story with you. Thank you so much.
Hi, as Udi mentioned, my name is Shir. As you can hear, and as you probably understood, I'm not from the States, I'm from Israel. I'm sure you all guys know, but Israel is a very, very small country. Udi even presented the numbers. But I come from an even smaller city in Israel, which is called Yavne, very lovely. I had an awesome childhood. I was the captain of the volleyball team, even though we were the worst of the worst. What is that about me, actually? Am I the captain of the worst? Like, am I good? Is it bad? Never mind. So I also was the chairman of the student council. I used to write for the high school newspaper. You know, one of the students that gets involved in everything. That was me, and I had an awesome childhood. And I want to tell you a bit about my family. I have one sister. She's older than me. Actually, she's getting married in May, and we're super excited. And this is little me, tons of attitude. But it was fun growing up. And actually, I want to tell you a story a bit about my grandparents. So in this picture is me and my grandfather as I finished the training for the IDF, which I will elaborate later, of course. And in the black and white picture is my grandfather and my grandmother, who passed away a few years ago, and with my baby father. My grandfather and my grandmother and my father are originally from Romania. And my grandfather comes from a very small village in Romania, which was known for its Jewish population and therefore was almost completely destroyed during World War II. His father was sent to concentration camp where he died. I don't know how my grandfather and his older brother weren't sent to concentration camp. It was some kind of a miracle, I have to say, because young men at their age will usually get sent to concentration camps, but they didn't. And his brother and his mother were deported from that small village into a bigger town because his village was conquered by the Nazis. And actually, during that deportation, he met my grandmother. They fell in love, even though he was 10 years older than she. He used to tell her, "You don't want to marry an old man." But she said, "Shush, stop talking nonsense." So after the war ended, they tried to establish a home in Romania. They had my dad. But something was missing. And that something was the feeling of home. No matter how much they tried in Romania, they were a minority. In Romania, they felt like they had to hide the fact they were Jewish, even though the war ended, even though Romania was free-ish. And therefore, they decided to come to Israel. But at that time, Romania didn't allow people just to leave. So they actually had to pay bribe to get a visa to get out. And they had to sign papers that says that they don't come ever with any kind of claims to the Romanian government. And to be honest, in my grandmother's house now, there's a Hilton hotel. And it's the Romanian government, not us. So it's kind of crazy. My mother's side is a bit different. The picture in black and white shows my grandmother and grandfather. My grandmother was born in Casablanca, which is the biggest city in Morocco. And she tells the story about being smuggled to Israel before it was even Israel, before the establishment of the Jewish state. During her brother's bar mitzvah, which is a ceremony that every Jewish boy has to do when they turn 13, she was 14 and she was smuggled to Israel. An Arab man took her from Morocco. Being a 14-year-old, she just went with a local Arab man to Algeria, which is a different country in northern Africa. And from there, she was smuggled to France. She was in France for 5 months, and then she came to Israel. As I said, she came alone, knowing no language. She knew Moroccan, Arabic, and French. And she started to work in Tel Aviv as a waitress, where my grandfather, who passed away when I was very young, just saw her across the restaurant. They fell in love, and they had a beautiful family of 6 children. My mom is the 4th out of 6. When you are a Jew that comes from a Muslim country, we are known for having a lot of children. Like, my dad has only 1 sister, my mom has 5. So there's something that, besides the holidays and the great food, we also have big families, which is a lot of fun. So right now I'm in law school, actually in my 3rd year of law school, and I go to school in Sapir Academic College, which is located in Sderot. I know some of you have been to Israel, so probably know, but it still shows on the map, on the right map, where Sderot is. As Udi said, Sderot and Netivot are 2 cities very, very close to the Gaza Strip, and I'm not going to elaborate what it means because Udi has been very good on it. The second map shows how much time we have to run for shelter in case the siren goes off. The siren is basically Israel letting us know that there's a bomb, there's a missile, there's a rocket coming towards us, go and run and go for shelter. So in Sderot, you have up to 15 seconds to run for shelter. I want you to try to imagine yourselves having 15 seconds, up to 15 seconds, to run for shelter. That is why Israel has it in a bill, a mandatory bill, that we have to have bomb shelters in our homes. Because if there wasn't, there's no way someone could get to a bomb shelter, even if it's just across your front door, in 15 seconds. It's impossible. So during my first year of school, I took a part in a Big Brother program where I mentored an 11-year-old girl from Sderot. She was born and raised in Sderot. That means being 11, the only reality she knows, as Udi said very well, is being under fire. So I'm from Yavne, as I said, and Yavne is in the dark green part, which means we have in my parents' house until a minute, up to a minute and a half to run full shelter. So I was in her house, we were doing homework, and all of a sudden the siren goes off. Now the siren in Sderot is not like the siren in Yavne. In Yavne it's just like voices coming up and down. In Sderot you can hear a voice saying red alert, red alert, red alert. I've never experienced something like this, so I was totally freaking out, like, what is going on? And she's like totally like indifferent, she used to it. Now I can't let her know that I'm freaking out because I'm the adult and we're just the two of us, and I'm supposed to be like, I'm 20 something, she's 11, and we run full shelter. We close the window, we close the door, everything has to be closed. And it's a small room, as Udi said, two single beds, a mini fridge, and four bags. A bag for each member of the family. And I asked her, what are those bags for? Like, why do you need a bag? This is such a little room. You can put a closet or something else. And she said those are their getaway bags. Because for now, for the last 3 years, there's been relatively, as Udi said, calm in the south, calm times. But ever since we disengaged from the Gaza Strip, the south has been taking a lot of fire, and it's been very unsafe to live there. So whenever things get rough, they will just run off to Nahariya. Nahariya is a city that borders with Lebanon. So imagine that they go from one dangerous, let's say, zone to another that once was very unsafe either. And they have family there, so they just run up to the north. I asked her if she can show me what's in the bag. She did. Her favorite teddy bear was in the bag. And I said, if it's your favorite, then why it's in the bag? Like, play with it, do like use it. And she said that she's afraid to forget it in case they're gonna have to flee. That's something that still goes with me every day, because it was super intense to hear an 11-year-old girl saying those things. When I was 11, my only concern was if it's too dark for me to play outside, if my mom would be concerned that it's too dark and I might get lost. There was no threat of missiles and rockets and the reality of running away for your life. So think about your children, your grandchildren, the people you love have to live in that kind of fear when they're just 11, like their hearts are still pure. And they have to live with that kind of reality. It's just insane. And as Udi said perfectly, this is why Israel has to have a defense force. This is why there has a mandatory military service. And this is why when I turned 18 in 2012, I joined the IDF. This is a photo with a camel, because I know a lot of Americans think that Israel is just camels, but we also have cars. So, yeah, and the other picture is me with my friends relatively before I finished my service. You can see the ranks. If you have three stripes for a girl, that means that you're almost at your end. Yay. And so I was lucky to do a very unique job. My job was basically, I was an instructor. I used to teach soldiers and train soldiers how to fire a missile. This weapon, this is all clips from YouTube, because up until recently, the missile was confidential. The unit was top secret, but there's now clips on YouTube that I can show you pieces from. So then the first picture is like the missile, it's the camera, and this is what the soldiers can see from the screen. And my job was basically to know everything there is to know about the missile and just teach the soldiers how to fire it. So this is the handle, the use. At first, it feels we have simulators and everything, and it felt super futuristic at first, but actually it's not. And I have a few pictures in here. The first one is when we aim to a tank, which is up in a practice, because at first the thought was that the threat is Syrian tanks, because this missile was invented after the war in 73. But now we realize that the threat are not Syrian tanks or individual terrorists that fire rockets through Israel. This is what the second picture is from actual shooting. It's from an operation against Hamas in 2009. And as you can see, I tried to circle it. This man is holding a rocket launcher, and he's not holding it anymore, if you know what I mean. And this picture is from the Second Lebanon War in 2006. And this is actually very interesting, because we had troops in Lebanon and this house was firing them from this house. And the troops asked us, because the soldiers, they sit in lunchers miles from the target. They actually very far away from the target. So they asked us to shoot to this house so we won't stop shooting towards them. So you need to understand what is so special about this missile is it super, super, super accurate. Which means if, God forbid, it will hit this room, the room next to us will stay unharmed. The reality is that the IDF and the Israeli government are putting so much money and effort in developing these kind of weapons to minimize casualties as much as possible. And believe me, this missile cost a fortune to the Israeli government and to the IDF, and this is a price we're willing to pay in order to minimize the casualties on the other side. As Udi said, and I totally agree with him, I'm very proud to say that I served at the IDF, and this is the job that I did. I believe that not only that we defended Israel, we also protected the civilians in Gaza from Hamas, who are using them as human shields. So this is the IDF I served in. This is the military I took part of. And when I finished my service, all the Israelis would take a big trip abroad. So, of course, I came to the States, and I went to Disneyland. Who doesn't want to go to Disneyland? Even though you're 21, you want to go to Disneyland. I went to Washington in Purim, which is like our Halloween. I dressed as Britney from Hit Me Baby One More Time. I love Britney. And I wanna finish with something that my mom used to tell me. I know when in the States, when you finish high school and you turn 18, you get all stressed out about college applications and when you're going to go to school and everything. But when we turn 18, the thing that worries us is what we're going to do with our next 2, if you're a girl, or 3 years, if you're a boy, in your military service. My mom, she was an officer for 15 years in the IDF. And I asked her, wow, mom, what am I going to do like this the next 2 years? I want to be meaningful. I want to do something meaningful between the 2 years. I didn't want to just pass it by. So she told me, don't worry, when you'll be 18, there'll be no army, there'll be no mandatory draft, there'll be peace. You don't need to concern yourself with these kinds of stuff. Unfortunately, in my time, there's no peace, but I'm all hope that one day I can be able to tell my children, when I was 18, million years ago, I did this and that, but you don't have to. Don't bother yourself, there's peace. I want to invite Udi to answer questions, any questions you have. And again, I heard from Udi just the best things about this place, and I'm so excited to be here. And thank you again for having us and listening. Thank you.
Sit right here. Just so they, you guys a little bit, how many of you have been to Israel? All right. Isn't that great? Now, I got a quiz for you guys. What is so significant about Yavne, where she lives? All right. 70 AD or CE, the temple is destroyed. Where does the Sanhedrin go? Yochanan ben Zakkai, he goes and he starts. This is where Judaism begins, in Yavne, after the destruction of the temple. That's what's so significant. Okay, yeah. But anyway, I just wanted you to know about that about Yavne. A very, very significant place to be from. But like they said, they're going to answer any questions. And I love this about them, that they open it up to you guys. So if you have any questions, just direct it to whoever and they'll answer.
Before I start, I just saw this, taking Torah to the nations. That's amazing. And it reminded me of about 2 weeks ago, or like even 3 maybe, Jews around the world started reading the Torah from the beginning, from Genesis, Bereshit. Do you know what the first Rashi is? The first question that the most famous commentator of the Torah is? They're covered. They know it.
Okay. They may not remember what I told them.
Talks about the nations. He doesn't even talk about Israel. Why? So, yeah. So Rashi asks, why does the Torah talk about like the creation of the world and the 7 days and all of that. It should have started with Exodus, with the formation of the Israeli people and their selection and the Torah. But he answers, so that if the nations will come to us and will say, you robbed this land, we can direct them. Everything belongs to God and God gave it to us. That's the first Rashi. So go ahead if you have questions for
any kind of question,
either one of us.
Everything. Just ask it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm saying all of us know. All of us.
If you come to an Israeli's house 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake him up. Who's your best friend? We say America. No hesitation. Honestly, we've had friends. America didn't want Israel to declare independence. There was issues with the Cold War. We were friends with France and the UK. They actually pushed Israel to go into one war over the Suez Canal. But ever since the 60s, ever since the Six-Day War, America has put itself and proven to be the first frontier for Israel. There are other countries that support Israel, but no one like the United States. And what not like the United States. And what I like about the support of the United States that it's bipartisan. But doesn't matter if presidents from are from one party or the other, they always support Israel. To some extent, they have different ideas of what is good for Israel and for the area. But I like how bipartisan that is. So we know and appreciate it. Thank you.
Actually, yeah, we just been to a school this morning, to a yeshiva, and this boy came up to us and he said, I'm going to join the IDF next summer. So it's something that is relatively going growing. It's called Lone Soldiers, not just Americans, all Jews from different countries that feel the need and the obligation maybe to come and serve and protect the state of Israel. And it's such a beautiful thing. Like, I was crying that I have to get a 3-hour bus drive from my house to the base, but they're actually leaving their countries and their whole families. Like, not just, I'm calling my mom, it's the same. There's something that is just, I feel blessed that there are people who are willing to do that for my country that feel like this their country too. So it's still happening. Oh, thank you.
Culture. Sadly, I feel like at times the Israelis themselves will be so divided. The only thing that will bring us back together to consolidate as one nation is external threats. And the United States live in a state of prosperity, and sometimes good times create mediocre people. And there are generation theories that I find to be very interesting of how hard times make good people. But then when you're prosperous, you can allow yourself to be so divided, and then you import ideas from all these dubious places that I don't think are suitable for such a great nation. But I'm not at the level to tell Americans how to. It's your decisions.
Actually, the Druze community in Israel, they have almost 100% of joining, like, drafting to the military. There are also a few, and we have a friend from Stan with us that is now touring the New York area, and he's Bedouin, and he also served in the IDF. And most Arabs are not obligate to serve because of security reasons. If they go to like very secret in the unit in the intelligence, they might transform the information. But if you want it bad enough, you can volunteer. And I think it's the same about Christians, right?
Christian Arabs? Yeah, with Christian Arabs, it will be higher. But Muslim Arabs... Sorry. We cannot play naive and not acknowledge the fact that our enemies are, for the most part, are Arabs. So you wouldn't take someone and tell him, go fight someone that might as well be his cousin. That's just not being sensitive. So we try to. But again, like Shir said, if you want to go to the military, you can volunteer. You can also volunteer. Not everybody has to go to the military, but that's the thing. You have to give couple of years, 3 years to your country back. You can do that by going and working with autistic kids, with kids with autism, like my cousin did. You can go and work as a in a hospital, like my best friend did. Or you can go to the military, like Shira and I did. So ultra-Orthodox Jews, Jews that dedicate their entire lives to the Torah. So they study from morning to night, not even dawn to dusk. Morning before dawn and after the sun sets. So Ben-Gurion, which was our first prime minister, said these people, they are fighting for Israel in a different frontier and they should be exempt from the military. That's good enough that they keep the torch burning, the torch of the Torah. And for me, it's easy because I don't study Torah as much as I should. And it's good that these people, I can come with to them with questions when I don't know things. And they have that information. So it started like that. The ultra-Orthodox community has grown and grown. And now they comprise about 8% of the population of Israel. And they're still exempt. A lot of them choose to come to the military and enlist. But some of them don't. Within these people who are our brothers and sisters, no matter how different we have on life, they're still our brothers and sisters. Some of them are sadly extreme, and they don't even support the idea of Israel because of some convoluted religious ideas that I honestly, I don't want to even give time to. And these people, they act not in a kind way to a lot of people. And our military, you know what? It doesn't matter, men, women. You don't mess with us. So, so you saw her. So yeah, I'm proud of her too. You have to, you know, it doesn't matter who you are if you don't accept that Israel is a state of law, it's a country of laws and law and order. You will face the repercussions.
And if I can add to that, in the previous government, there was a minister named Yair Lapid. Have you heard of him? Yeah. So he tried to pass a bill which is called Chok Tal in Israel, which was actually canceling the liberty that the Haredim had not to serve. But this government canceled that bill. And now they don't have to serve again. I want to say from my point of view, as a woman who served 2 years in the IDF, I feel unfair. I feel like I don't see why I need to give 2 years of my life, and all of my friends did, to protect them. As much as the thing they're doing is important and has a value, I personally think that they should serve. And I think this is why a lot of people think like me. This is why we have diversity about that subject in Israel. And the second, go ahead.
You had a follow-up.
Yeah, the second question.
I feel like the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem is more of a symbolic thing, and then it's more than anything. I know that to come here, I had to take my visa. And it's in Tel Aviv, it's close to the beach, it's very beautiful, you can go grab lunch at the beach after that, the transportation is super comfortable. And I think that if it was in Jerusalem, as a civilian, as an Israeli, it would be very difficult for me to get there, because the transportation to Jerusalem is not as fast as going to Tel Aviv, it's more distant. So if you say I came from, as I said, I lived in a kibbutz near Sderot, so coming from Sderot to Tel Aviv is way more easy than coming from Sderot to Jerusalem. So just my opinion as an Israeli, I would rather to keep it in Tel Aviv, so it'd be much more comfortable for me to get there. But if Woody thinks otherwise.
Yes, you know the saying, two Jews, three opinions. So I disagree. I think it was George Bush the father who coined the term bigotry of low expectations. Why do we not move the embassy to Jerusalem, something that's long overdue? It's out of the fear that the Palestinians will go on a frenzy and start killing Jews. What does it say about us that we think that Palestinians have such poor judgment, just putting a symbolic embassy in West Jerusalem, Western Jerusalem? I'm not even talking about Eastern Jerusalem. We'll send them in. How low our opinion is of them that they will just go on killing sprees for nothing, basically. I hate that. I think that Jerusalem, that's the capital, I think that's the spiritual center, not only for Israel, but for the entire world. I think that there is energy that is exuded from that place, and it will be a good thing for the United States and for America if the embassy was there.
So maybe that answers your question.
About how many missiles did Hamas shoot from Gaza to Sderot over the last 10 years? Or what? Give people an idea.
Yeah, I don't know about Sderot specifically, but that area has, we've had an extensive, what we call it, metal export from the Gaza Strip to Israel. 20,000 rockets and mortars that have been shot. 20,000 in the past couple of decades. Each one of them can take lives.
And took
life. A couple of years back, a missile in Be'eri, a small kibbutz near my house, decapitated a four-year-old named Daniel Tungman. I get chills every time I talk about it. What was his greatest crime? His mother reaching for his little baby brother first. She didn't have time. It was 15 seconds. He's not with us again.
Actually, as I said, I lived in kibbutz and in Sderot near the Gaza Strip, and I have friends that are living in kibbutzim, which is agriculture communities closer to the Gaza Strip than me. And last year, they heard digging under their homes, and they actually said, "Okay, I'm gonna move to my parents in the center of Israel. I'm gonna come with the train to school. I'm not staying here," because they actually heard digging. And this, I'm not ready that some Arab's gonna pop up off my sink. Like I don't want that. So they moved to their parents' house for a while. I think things got calm, and then they came back. But you can sense it. You can feel it.
What can you tell us about the underground air force?
The underground air force.
Is there air force that's?
It also goes to Mars and under the ocean. I wasn't aware of underground air force. Maybe it's just me not, you know, keeping track with. I do know. So again, I told you Israel is trying to do the moral thing, and one option that came up with tunnels is just to bring seawater and drown these terrorists to death. Our Supreme Court, when they heard about the IDF, that suggestion, they said, "We cannot do that. That's too inhumane. People that have gone through the Holocaust cannot cause that such. It doesn't matter if they're animals. We're not going to corrupt ourselves resorting to these measures." Luckily, we have a neighbor to the south called Egypt. They are bound to no such protocol, and they just flood all the tunnels that connect the Rafah, the Egyptian Rafah, and the Gaza Rafah.
Go Egypt.
You know, Jordan, we had peace that is much more straightforward. It was peace for peace. It wasn't like peace for land like we had with Egypt. They have completely relinquished all their claims over the West Bank. There have been small, minute land swaps, and we supply water and electricity to some extent. I don't know. You tell me, what should I think about a country that a Pew research tells me that 97% of people say yes when they're asked, "Do you have unfavorable views of Jews?" Let it just sink in. It's not Israelis even. 97% claiming to an anti-Semitic saying yes, "I have unfavorable views of Jews." So sure, we'll cooperate on the state level. We'll make sure that border is calm. But I don't think highly of them.
What's the most important thing the American people can do as like individuals, not like as a government, to support Israel?
As I heard from you guys go to Israel and you talk about Israel and you support, and you're here, you're supporting us, you're supporting Israel, and I think that's the most beautiful thing you can do and you need to do, is to keep supporting, is to keep being Israel's best friend, which you are, and just keep on doing what you're doing, because it just warms my heart to know there's people in Washington they think highly of me and my state and my friends, and they want us to be safe. And this is just keep on doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Yeah, so I can sense winds of change in Saudi Arabia. Honestly, Saudi Arabia that actually joined the war of independence against Israel has become much more moderate. I hear that there are like secret talks that take place weekly in Jordan between the Israeli, Saudis, Egyptians, and a warmer and safer. I read a journalist from the New York Times saying that a warmer relations for Saudi Arabia with the Israelis could be the best thing that happened to them since the dinosaurs died.
If I can answer that, the things are not good. Right now, there's, as you can call, a civil war in Syria, and every once in a while, also Ramat Golan in Israel is getting, by accident, fires, and we always react so they can know they cannot mess with us. And as far as I know, when once they're going to finish doing what they're doing now in Syria, fight among themselves, the fire is going to come to us. Yeah. And we're prepared for everything. And bring it on.
Just an anecdote. About like 30 years ago, Iran and Iraq went into war, both enemies of Israel back then. So when Menachem Begin was asked, because now we have a similar thing. We have Hezbollah and ISIS fighting each other in Lebanon. So he was asked, what do you think about Iran fighting Iraq? And he said, good luck to both sides. Iran, like hands down, that a country that day and night says that they want to destroy Israel and they pursue the means to do so, nuclear weapons. You know, a Palestinian terrorist that will wake up this morning and will throw stones on cars in Judea Samaria, something that happens daily. We don't hear about it, but it happens. We experience these terror attacks every day. That might be devastating. And and every soul that has been taken is a full world, like Rambam taught us. But nothing comes close to a nuclear bomb in such a concentrated area like Gush Dan. That's the closest that a second Holocaust. When we say never again, that's what we have in mind. This is why our prime minister is so adamant about countering that.
After you serve your 2-3 years, are you always possibly pulled up if need be?
Actually, it depends on your job, what you did. Usually girls don't. But because I had such a unique position, I was called to, how do you say, reserved, in the last March, and which means that if they call me, things are not as good as you want them to be. But the combat soldiers, mostly the boys, are all constantly training, being in shape in case, God forbid, something's going to happen. We will be prepared. And I know Uri always said that Israel is the 11th strongest military force. And actually, when I had my bat mitzvah, which is like when a girl turns 12, like when a boy turns 13, so when a boy turns 12, my parents took me to the States to a coast-to-coast trip, and it was in 2006 where the second Lebanon war took place. And I saw on the news on the hotel that there's a war. And I asked my mom, oh my God, like my family, like my grandparents, all of is in Israel, what's going to happen? And she told me, don't worry, Israel has the best military in the world. And that calmed me down. And even though by statistic it's the 11th, I feel that's number one that's going to protect me and my country. Yeah.
As a woman, how do you feel about women being in combat?
On one hand, I'm very happy that there are women in combat units because it's equality, yeah? Equality. And there's nothing that a woman want to do and she can't do. Women can be pilots. That's amazing. But with that being said, there's the concern that a combat soldier, a female combat soldier, will get abducted or raped or whatever. I don't want to even think about it. So not every woman can go to any combat unit. There are specific combat units that women can take part in until it's not super dangerous for them. But basically, if you want to go if you want to be a combat, you need to go through some kind of training. Yeah, like special training. You need to see that you're fitted enough, that you want this enough, that you're in shape. And if you stand in all those criterias, you'll be able to go to combat, but only to specific unit that doesn't jeopardize the women too much.
Maybe just one last question. We have an early morning tomorrow. We'll stay here if you want to ask us more questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, there's two questions. At first, when I enlisted to school in Sderot, my parents and my family and all my friends were like, why would you go to school there? It's like you pick the most unsafe place to go to school to. And I said, hey, it's right. It's not the safest place on earth to go to school. But because of the situation, because it's been fired all the time, it actually is one of the most safest place to be. Every few meters, we have bomb shelters. We have protocols in all the classrooms where we need to evacuate in case of a siren, if we can stay, if we can go. And I hope that answering your question, if I don't go to school in Sderot and no one goes to school in Sderot, there will be no Sderot. Everyone will leave, and they basically will accomplish what they want, which is take lands and make us so afraid that we'll just leave. No, we're braver and we're stronger than that. And even though I have monuments in my school, in 2007, here a rocket fell. Then in 2008, a rocket fell here. I will go to the bomb shelter and I will be safe. Maybe the building will get damaged, but our lives and our spirit will stay unharmed, and we'll continue to go to school there and we'll continue our lives.
When Churchill addressed the agreement that Britain had with Germany, Nazi Germany, he said they could have picked war or disgrace. They picked disgrace and got war as well. If we go and evacuate all these areas, and that is basically choosing disgrace, we'll get war eventually, but it will be in Tel Aviv and not in Netivot.
You had a question?
Yeah, go ahead. My favorite book in the Bible, or the favorite story, is the book of Job. I feel like I just enjoy reading it, but it's not really Job.
Okay.
Just beautifully made. I love it. Whenever I'm down, I read it, and I was like, I belong to the nation that had the person to write this genius piece of art. But he wasn't really prophesizing on what's going to happen. I think the Ezekiel and Isaiah are the ones to, you know, talk about how from the north will be, you know, we'll have the evil will come, and talk about immorality in Jerusalem that leads to destruction. I feel like we can do much better as Israelis, all people, I think, to be more and more moral, to be on an everlasting pursuit to be much more moral than we are. So when I worked in the Knesset, I met him. I'm a small person, so it's weird to commentate on him, but he's a stand-up guy. He's amazing. His philosophy is the liberal philosophy. What do you mean? How can you tell me that when I had to go to Temple Mount, I had to hide my Magen David and to make sure that my kippah is showing, and I can't even bow or bring an Israeli flag to Temple Mount? How can you tell me that we have an institutionalized racism and discrimination against Jews. And I go to schools here in Marysville, and I have a teacher yelling at me, telling me that Israel does not allow Muslims to pray in Al-Aqsa. Yeah, and I'm telling her, you have it backwards. It's us, the Jews, who are not allowed. And she tells me we have different opinions. It's... Thank you so much. We're going to be here.